Chamber's Chamberlain. That explains a lot, Vittoria thought. She had always possessed a well-tuned perception for others' inner emotions, and something about the Camerlingo had been nagging her all day. Since meeting him, she had sensed an anguish more soulful and private than the overwhelming crisis he now faced. Behind his pious calm, she saw a man tormented by personal demons. Now she knew her instincts had been correct. Not only was he facing the most devastating threat in Vatican history, but he was doing it without his mentor and friend, flying solo. The guards slowed now, as if unsure where exactly in the darkness the most recent pope was buried. The Camerlingo continued assuredly and stopped before a marble tomb that seemed to glisten brighter than the others. Lying atop was a carved figure of the late pope. When Vittoria recognized his face from television, a shot of fear gripped her. What are we doing? I realize we do not have much time, the Camerlingo said. I still ask we take a moment of prayer. The Swiss guard all bowed their heads where they were standing. Vittoria followed suit, her heart pounding in the silence. The Camerlingo knelt before the tomb and prayed in Italian. As Vittoria listened to his words, an unexpected grief surfaced as tears. Tears for her own mentor, her own holy father. The Camerlingo's words seemed as appropriate for her father as they did for the Pope. Supreme Father, Counselor, Friend, the Camerlingo's voice echoed dully around the ring. You told me when I was young that the voice in my heart was that of God. You told me I must follow it no matter what painful places it leads. I hear that voice now, asking of me impossible tasks. Give me strength. Bestow on me forgiveness. What I do in the name of everything you believe. Amen. Amen, the guards whispered. Amen, Father. Vittoria wiped her eyes. The Camerlingo stood slowly and stepped away from the tomb. Push the covering aside. The Swiss guards hesitated. Signore, one said, by law we are at your command, he paused. We will do as you say. The Camerlingo seemed to read the young man's mind. Someday I will ask your forgiveness for placing you in this position. Today I ask for your obedience. Vatican laws are established to protect this church. It is in that very spirit that I command you to break them now. There was a moment of silence, and then the lead guard gave the order. The three men set down their flashlights on the floor, and their shadows leapt overhead. Lit now from beneath, the men advanced toward the tomb. Bracing their hands against the marble covering near the head of the tomb, they planted their feet and prepared to push. On signal, they all thrust, straining against the enormous slab. When the lid did not move at all, Vittoria found herself almost hoping it was too heavy. She was suddenly fearful of what they would find inside. The men pushed harder, and still the stone did not move. Ancora, the Camerlingo said, rolling up the sleeves of his cassock and preparing to push along with them. Ora, everyone heaved. Vittoria was about to offer her own help, but just then the lid began to slide. The men dug in again, and with an almost primal growl of stone on stone, the lid rotated off the top of the tomb and came to rest at an angle. The Pope's carved head now pushed back into the niche and his feet extending out into the hallway. Everyone stepped back. Tentatively, a guard bent and retrieved his flashlight. Then he aimed it into the tomb. The beam seemed to tremble a moment, and then the guard held it steady. The other guards gathered one by one. Even in the darkness, Vittoria sensed them recoil. In succession, they crossed themselves. The Camerlingo shuddered when he looked into the tomb, his shoulders dropping like weights. He stood a long moment before turning away. Vittoria had feared the corpse's mouth might be clenched tight with rigor mortis, and that she would have to suggest breaking the jaw to see the tongue. Now she saw it would be unnecessary. The cheeks had collapsed, and the Pope's mouth gaped wide. His tongue was black as death. Chapter 86. No light, no sound. The secret archives were black. Fear, Langdon now realized, was an intense motivator. Short of breath, he fumbled through the blackness toward the revolving door. He found the button on the wall and rammed his palm against it. Nothing happened. He tried again. The door was dead. Spinning, blind, he called out, but his voice emerged strangled. The peril of his predicament suddenly closed in around him. His lungs strained for oxygen as the adrenaline doubled his heart rate. He felt like someone had just punched him in the gut. When he threw his weight into the door, for an instant he thought he felt the door start to turn. He pushed again, seeing stars. Now he realized it was the entire room turning, not the door. Staggering away, Langdon tripped over the base of a rolling ladder and fell hard. He tore his knee against the edge of a bookstack. Swearing, he got up and groped for the ladder. He found it. He had hoped it would be heavy wood or iron, but it was aluminum. He grabbed the ladder and held it like a battering ram. Then he ran through the dark at the glass wall. It was closer than he thought. The ladder hit head-on, bouncing off. From the feeble sound of the collision, Langdon knew he was going to need a hell of a lot more than an aluminum ladder to break this glass. When he flashed on the semi-automatic, his hope surged and then instantly fell. The weapon was gone. Olivetti had relieved him of it in the Pope's office, saying he didn't want loaded weapons around with a Camerlengo present. It made sense at the time. Langdon called out again, making less sound than the last time. Next, he remembered the walkie-talkie the guard had left on the table outside the vault. Why the hell didn't I bring it in? As the purple stars began to dance before his eyes, Langdon forced himself to think. You've been trapped before, he told himself. You survived worse. You were just a kid and you figured it out. The crushing darkness came flooding in. Think! Langdon lowered himself onto the floor. He rolled over on his back and laid his hands at his sides. The first step was to gain control. Relax. Conserve. No longer fighting gravity to pump blood, Langdon's heart began to slow. It was a trick swimmers used to re-oxygenate their blood between tightly scheduled races. There is plenty of air in here, he told himself. Plenty. Now think. He waited, half expecting the lights to come back on at any moment. They didn't. As he lay there, able to breathe better now, an eerie resignation came across him. He felt peaceful. He fought it. You will move, damn it. But where? On Langdon's wrist, Mickey Mouse glowed happily, as if enjoying the dark. 9:33 p.m., half an hour until fire. Langdon thought it felt a whole hell of a lot later. His mind, instead of coming up with a plan for escape, was suddenly demanding an explanation. Who turned off the power? Was Roche expanding his search? Wouldn't Olivetti have warned Roche that I'm in here? Langdon knew at this point it made no difference. Opening his mouth wide and tipping back his head, Langdon pulled the deepest breaths he could manage. Each breath burned a little less than the last. His head cleared. He reeled his thoughts in and forced the gears into motion. Glass walls, he told himself, but damn thick glass. He wondered if any of the books in here were stored in heavy, steel, fireproof file cabinets. Langdon had seen them from time to time in other archives, but had seen none here. Besides, finding one in the dark could prove time-consuming. Not that he could lift one anyway, particularly in his present state. How about the examination table? Langdon knew this vault, like the other, had an examination table in the center of the stacks. So what? He knew he couldn't lift it. Not to mention, even if he could drag it, he wouldn't get it far. The stacks were closely packed, the aisles between them far too narrow. The aisles are too narrow. Suddenly, Langdon knew. With a burst of confidence, he jumped to his feet far too fast. Swaying in the fog of a head rush, he reached out in the dark for support. His hand found a stack. Waiting a moment, he forced himself to conserve. He would need all of his strength to do this. Positioning himself against the book stack like a football player against a training sled, he planted his feet and pushed. If I can somehow tip the shelf. But it barely moved. He realigned and pushed again. His feet slipped backward on the floor. The stack creaked, but didn't move. He needed leverage. Finding the glass wall again, he placed one hand on it to guide him as he raced in the dark toward the far end of the vault. The back wall loomed suddenly, and he collided with it, crushing his shoulder. Cursing, Langdon circled the shelf and grabbed the stack at about eye level. Then, propping one leg on the glass behind him and another on the lower shelves, he started to climb. Books fell around him, fluttering into the darkness. He didn't care. Instinct for survival had long since overridden archival decorum. He sensed his equilibrium was hampered by the total darkness and closed his eyes, coaxing his brain to ignore visual input. He moved faster now. The air felt leaner the higher he went. He scrambled toward the upper shelves, stepping on books, trying to gain purchase, heaving himself upward. Then, like a rock climber conquering a rock face, Langdon grasped the top shelf. Stretching his legs out behind him, he walked his feet up the glass wall until he was almost horizontal. "Now or never, Robert," a voice urged. "Just like the leg press in the Harvard gym." With dizzying exertion, he planted his feet against the wall behind him, braced his arms and chest against the stack, and pushed. Nothing happened. Fighting for air, he repositioned and tried again, extending his legs. Ever so slightly, the stack moved. He pushed again, and the stack rocked forward an inch or two, and then back. Langdon took advantage of the motion, inhaling what felt like oxygenless breath, and heaving again. The shelf rocked farther. "Like a swing set," he told himself. "Keep the rhythm. A little more." Langdon rocked the shelf, extending his legs farther with each push. His quadriceps burned now, and he blocked the pain. The pendulum was in motion. "Three more pushes," he urged himself. It only took two. There was an instant of weightless uncertainty. Then, with a thundering of books sliding off the shelves, Langdon and the shelf were falling forward. Halfway to the ground, the shelf hit the stack next to it. Langdon hung on, throwing his weight forward, urging the second shelf to topple. There was a moment of motionless panic, and then, creaking under the weight, the second stack began to tip. Langdon was falling again. Like enormous dominoes, the stacks began to topple one after another. Metal on metal, books tumbling everywhere. Langdon held on as his inclined stack bounced downward like a ratchet on a jack. He wondered how many stacks there were in all. How much would they weigh? The glass at the far end was thick. Langdon's stack had fallen almost to the horizontal when he heard what he was waiting for, a different kind of collision. Far off, at the end of the vault, the sharp smack of metal on glass. The vault around him shook, and Langdon knew the final stack, weighted down by the others, had hit the glass hard. The sound that followed was the most unwelcome sound Langdon had ever heard. Silence. There was no crashing of glass, only the resounding thud as the wall accepted the weight of the stacks now propped against it. He lay wide-eyed on the pile of books. Somewhere in the distance there was a creaking. Langdon would have held his breath to listen, but he had none left to hold. 1 second, two. Then, as he teetered on the brink of unconsciousness, Langdon heard a distant yielding, a ripple spidering outward through the glass. Suddenly, like a cannon, the glass exploded. The stack beneath Langdon collapsed to the floor. Like welcome rain on a desert, shards of glass tinkled downward in the dark. With a great sucking hiss, the air gushed in. 30 seconds later, in the Vatican grottos, Vittoria was standing before a corpse when the electronic squawk of a walkie-talkie broke the silence. The voice blaring out sounded short of breath. "This is Robert Langdon. Can anyone hear me?" Vittoria looked up. Robert! She couldn't believe how much she suddenly wished he were there. The guards exchanged puzzled looks. One took a radio off his belt. "Mr. Langdon, you're on Channel 3. The commander is waiting to hear from you on Channel 1. "I know he's on Channel 1, damn it. I don't want to speak to him. I want the Camerlengo. Now! Somebody find him for me." In the obscurity of the secret archives, Langdon stood amidst shattered glass and tried to catch his breath. He felt a warm liquid on his left hand and knew he was bleeding. The Camerlengo's voice spoke at once, startling Langdon. "This is Camerlengo Ventresca. What's going on?" Langdon pressed the button, his heart still pounding. "I think somebody just tried to kill me." There was a silence on the line. Langdon tried to calm himself. "I also know where the next killing is going to be." The voice that came back was not the Camerlengo's. It was Commander Olivetti's. "Mr. Langdon, do not speak another word." Chapter 87. Langdon's watch, now smeared with blood, read 9:41 p.m. as he ran across the courtyard of the Belvedere and approached the fountain outside the Swiss Guard Security Center. His hand had stopped bleeding and now felt worse than it looked. As he arrived, it seemed everyone convened at once. Olivetti, Rocher, the Camerlengo, Vittoria, and a handful of guards. Vittoria hurried toward him immediately. "Robert, you're hurt!" Before Langdon could answer, Olivetti was before him. "Mr. Langdon, I'm relieved you're okay. I'm sorry about the crossed signals in the archives." "Crossed signals?" Langdon demanded. "You knew damn well. It was my fault," Rocher said, stepping forward, sounding contrite. "I had no idea you were in the archives. Portions of our white zones are crosswired with that building. We were extending our search. I'm the one who killed Power. If I had known..." "Robert," Vittoria said, taking his wounded hand in hers and looking it over. "The Pope was poisoned. The Illuminati killed him." Langdon heard the words, but they barely registered. He was saturated. All he could feel was the warmth of Vittoria's hands. The Camerlengo pulled a silk handkerchief from his cassock and handed it to Langdon so he could clean himself. The man said nothing. His green eyes seemed filled with a new fire. "Robert," Vittoria pressed, "you said you found where the next cardinal is going to be killed?" Langdon felt flighty. "I do. It's at the..." "No," Olivetti interrupted. "Mr. Langdon, when I asked you not to speak another word on the walkie-talkie, it was for a reason." He turned to the handful of assembled Swiss guards. "Excuse us, gentlemen." The soldiers disappeared into the security center. No indignity, only compliance. Olivetti turned back to the remaining group. "As much as it pains me to say this, the murder of our Pope is an act that could have only been accomplished with help from within these walls. For the good of all, we can trust no one, including our guards." He seemed to be suffering as he spoke the words. Rocher looked anxious. "Inside collusion implies..." "Yes," Olivetti said. "The integrity of your search is compromised. And yet it is a gamble we must take. Keep looking." Rocher looked like he was about to say something, thought better of it, and left. The Camerlengo inhaled deeply. He had not said a word yet, and Langdon sensed a new rigor in the man, as if a turning point had been reached. "Commander," the Camerlengo's tone was impermeable, "I am going to break conclave." Olivetti pursed his lips, looking dour. "I advise against it. We still have 2 hours and 20 minutes. "A heartbeat." Olivetti's tone was now challenging. "What do you intend to do? Evacuate the cardinal single-handedly?" "I intend to save this church with whatever power God has given me. How I proceed is no longer your concern." Oliveri straightened. Whatever you intend to do, he paused, I do not have the authority to restrain you, particularly in light of my apparent failure as head of security. I ask only that you wait. Wait 20 minutes, until after 10 o'clock. If Mr. Langdon's information is correct, I may still have a chance to catch this assassin. There is still a chance to preserve protocol and decorum. Decorum! The Camerlengo let out a choked laugh. We have long since passed propriety, Commander. In case you hadn't noticed, this is war. A guard emerged from the security center and called out to the Camerlengo. Signore, I just got word. We have detained the BBC reporter, Mr. Glick. The Camerlengo nodded. Have both he and his camerawoman meet me outside the Sistine Chapel. Olivetti's eyes widened. What are you doing? 20 minutes, Commander. That's all I'm giving you. Then he was gone. When Olivetti's Alfa Romeo tore out of Vatican City, this time there was no line of unmarked cars following him. In the back seat, Vittoria bandaged Langdon's hand with a first aid kit she'd found in the glove box. Olivetti stared straight ahead. Okay, Mr. Langdon. Where are we going? Chapter 88. Even with its siren now affixed and blaring, Olivetti's Alfa Romeo seemed to go unnoticed as it rocketed across the bridge into the heart of old Rome. All the traffic was moving in the other direction, toward the Vatican, as if the Holy See had suddenly become the hottest entertainment in Rome. Langdon sat in the back seat, the questions whipping through his mind. He wondered about the killer, if they would catch him this time, if he would tell them what they needed to know, if it was already too late. How long before the Camerlengo told the crowd in St. Peter's Square they were in danger? The incident in the vault still nagged. A mistake. Olivetti never touched the brakes as he snaked the howling Alfa Romeo toward the Church of Santa Maria della Vittoria. Langdon knew on any other day his knuckles would have been white. At the moment, however, he felt anesthetized. Only the throbbing in his hand reminded him where he was. Overhead, the siren wailed. Nothing like telling them we're coming, Langdon thought. And yet they were making incredible time. He guessed Olivetti would kill the siren as they drew nearer. Now, with a moment to sit and reflect, Langdon felt a tinge of amazement as the news of the Pope's murder finally registered in his mind. The thought was inconceivable, and yet somehow it seemed a perfectly logical event. Infiltration had always been the Illuminati power base, rearrangements of power from within. And it was not as if popes had never been murdered. Countless rumors of treachery abounded, although with no autopsy, none was ever confirmed. Until recently. Academics not long ago had gotten permission to x-ray the tomb of Pope Celestine V, who had allegedly died at the hands of his overeager successor, Boniface VIII. The researchers had hoped the x-ray might reveal some small hint of foul play. A broken bone, perhaps. Incredibly, the x-ray had revealed a 10-inch nail driven into the Pope's skull. Langdon now recalled a series of news clippings fellow Illuminati buffs had sent him years ago. At first he had thought the clippings were a prank, so he'd gone to the Harvard microfiche collection to confirm the articles were authentic. Incredibly, they were. He now kept them on his bulletin board as examples of how even respectable news organizations sometimes got carried away with Illuminati paranoia. Suddenly, the media's suspicions seemed a lot less paranoid. Langdon could see the articles clearly in his mind. The British Broadcasting Corporation, June 14, 1998. Pope John Paul I, who died in 1978, fell victim to a plot by the P2 Masonic Lodge. The secret society, P2, decided to murder John Paul I when it saw he was determined to dismiss the American Archbishop Paul Marcinkus as president of the Vatican Bank. The bank had been implicated in shady financial dealings with the Masonic Lodge. The New York Times, August 24, 1998. Why was the late John Paul I wearing his day shirt in bed? Why was it torn? The questions don't stop there. No medical investigations were made. Cardinal Vio forbade an autopsy on the grounds that no pope was ever given a post-mortem. And John Paul's medicines mysteriously vanished from his bedside, as did his glasses, slippers, and his last will and testament. London Daily Mail, August 27, 1998. A plot including a powerful, ruthless, and illegal Masonic lodge with tentacles stretching into the Vatican. The cellular in Vittoria's pocket rang, thankfully erasing the memories from Langdon's mind. Vittoria answered, looking confused as to who might be calling her. Even from a few feet away, Langdon recognized the laser-like voice on the phone.
"Vittoria, this is Maximilian Kohler. Have you found the antimatter yet?"
"Max, you're okay?"
"I saw the news. There was no mention of CERN or the antimatter. This is good. What is happening?"
"We haven't located the canister yet. The situation is complex. Robert Langdon has been quite an asset. We have a lead on catching the man assassinating cardinals. Right now we're headed..."
"Miss Vetra,"
Olivetti interrupted,
"you've said enough."
She covered the receiver, clearly annoyed. "Commander, this is the president of CERN. Certainly he has a right to..."
"He has a right," Olivetti snapped, "to be here, handling the situation. You're on an open cellular line. You've said enough."
Vittoria took a deep breath. "Max."
"I may have some information for you," Max said, "about your father. I may know who he told about the antimatter."
Vittoria's expression clouded. "Max, my father said he told no one."
"I'm afraid, Vittoria, your father did tell someone. I need to check some security records. I will be in touch soon."
The line went dead. Vittoria looked waxen as she returned the phone to her pocket.
"You okay?"
Langdon asked. Vittoria nodded, her trembling fingers revealing the lie.
"The church is on Piazza Barberini,"
Olivetti said, killing the siren and checking his watch.
"We have 9 minutes."
When Langdon had first realized the location of the third marker, the position of the church had rung some distant bell for him. Piazza Barberini. Something about the name was familiar. Something he couldn't place. Now Langdon realized what it was. The piazza was the site of a controversial subway stop. 20 years ago, construction of the subway terminal had created a stir among art historians, who feared digging beneath Piazza Barberini might topple the multi-ton obelisk that stood in the center. City planners had removed the obelisk and replaced it with a small fountain called the Triton. In Bernini's day, Langdon now realized, Piazza Barberini had contained an obelisk. Whatever doubts Langdon had felt that this was the location of the third marker now totally evaporated. A block from the piazza, Olivetti turned into an alley, gunned the car halfway down, and skidded to a stop. He pulled off his suit jacket, rolled up his sleeves, and loaded his weapon.
"We can't risk your being recognized," he said. "You two were on television. I want you across the piazza, out of sight, watching the front entrance. I'm going in the back."
He produced a familiar pistol and handed it to Langdon.
"Just in case."
Langdon frowned. It was the second time today he had been handed a gun. He slid it into his breast pocket. As he did, he realized he was still carrying the folio from Diagramma. He couldn't believe he'd forgotten to leave it behind. He pictured the Vatican curator collapsing in spasms of outrage at the thought of this priceless artifact being packed around Rome like some tourist map. Then Langdon thought of the mess of shattered glass and strewn documents that he'd left behind in the archives. The curator had other problems, if the archives even survived the night. Olivetti got out of the car and motioned back up the alley.
"The piazza is that way. Keep your eyes open and don't let yourselves be seen."
He tapped the phone on his belt.
"Miss Vetra, let's retest our autodial."
Vittoria removed her phone and hit the autodial number she and Olivetti had programmed at the Pantheon. Olivetti's phone vibrated in silent ring mode on his belt.
The commander nodded. Good. If you see anything, I want to know. He cocked his weapon. I'll be inside waiting. This heathen is mine. At that moment, very nearby, another cellular phone was ringing. The Hashashin answered. Speak. It is I, the voice said. Janus. The Hashashin smiled. Hello, master. Your position may be known. Someone is coming to stop you. They are too late. I've already made the arrangements here. Good. Make sure you escape alive. There is work yet to be done. Those who stand in my way will die. Those who stand in your way are knowledgeable. You speak of an American scholar? You are aware of him? The Hashashin chuckled. Cool-tempered, but naive. He spoke to me on the phone earlier. He's with a female who seems quite the opposite. The killer felt a stirring of arousal as he recalled the fiery temperament of Leonardo Vetra's daughter. There was a momentary silence on the line, the first hesitation the Hashashin had ever sensed from his Illuminati master. Finally, Janus spoke. Eliminate them, if need be. The killer smiled. Consider it done. He felt a warm anticipation spreading through his body. Although the woman I may keep as a prize. Chapter 89. War had broken out in St. Peter's Square. The piazza had exploded into a frenzy of aggression. Media trucks skidded into place like assault vehicles claiming beachheads. Reporters unfurled high-tech electronics like soldiers arming for battle. All around the perimeter of the square, networks jockeyed for positions as they raced to erect the newest weapon in media wars, flat-screen displays. Flat-screen displays were enormous video screens that could be assembled on top of trucks or portable scaffolding. The screen served as a kind of billboard advertisement for the network, broadcasting that network's coverage and corporate logo like a drive-in movie. If a screen were well situated, in front of the action, for example, a competing network couldn't shoot the story without including an advertisement for their competitor. The square was quickly becoming not only a multimedia extravaganza, but a frenzied public vigil. Onlookers poured in from all directions. Open space in the usually limitless square was fast becoming a valuable commodity. People clustered around the towering flat-screen displays, listening to live reports in stunned excitement. Only 100 yards away, inside the thick walls of St. Peter's Basilica, the world was serene. Lieutenant Chartrand and 3 other guards moved through the darkness. Wearing their infrared goggles, they fanned out across the nave, swinging their detectors before them. The search of Vatican City's public access areas so far had yielded nothing. "Better remove your goggles up here," the senior guard said. Chartrand was already doing it. They were nearing the niche of the paliums, the sunken area in the center of the basilica. It was lit by 99 oil lamps, and the amplified infrared would have seared their eyes. Chartrand enjoyed being out of the heavy goggles, and he stretched his neck as they descended into the sunken niche to scan the area. The room was beautiful, golden and glowing. He had not been down here yet. It seemed every day since Chartrand had arrived in Vatican City, he had learned some new Vatican mystery. These oil lamps were one of them. There were exactly 99 lamps burning at all times. It was a tradition. The clergy vigilantly refilled the lamps with sacred oils, such that no lamp ever burned out. It was said they would burn until the end of time. Or at least until midnight, Chartrand thought, feeling his mouth go dry again. Chartrand swung his detector over the oil lamps. Nothing hidden in here. He wasn't surprised. The canister, according to the video feed, was hidden in a dark area. As he moved across the niche, he came to a bulkhead grate covering a hole in the floor. The hole led to a steep and narrow stairway that went straight down.
He had heard stories about what lay down there. Thankfully, they wouldn't have to descend. Roche's orders were clear. Search only the public access areas. Ignore the white zones. "What's that smell?" he asked, turning away from the grate. The niche smelled intoxicatingly sweet. "Fumes from the lamps," one of them replied. Chartrand was surprised. "Smells more like cologne than kerosene." "It's not kerosene. These lamps are close to the papal altar, so they take a special ambiental mixture. Ethanol, sugar, butane, and perfume." "Butane?" Chartrand eyed the lamps uneasily. The guard nodded. "Don't spill any. Smells like heaven, but burns like hell." The guards had completed searching the niche of the paliums and were moving across the basilica again when their walkie-talkies went off. It was an update. The guards listened in shock. Apparently there were troubling new developments, which could not be shared on air, but the Camerlengo had decided to break tradition and enter conclave to address the cardinals. Never before in history had this been done. Then again, Chartrand realized, never before in history had the Vatican been sitting on what amounted to some sort of neoteric nuclear warhead. Chartrand felt comforted to know the Camerlengo was taking control. The Camerlengo was the person inside Vatican City for whom Chartrand held the most respect. Some of the guards thought of the Camerlengo as a beato, a religious zealot whose love of God bordered on obsession. But even they agreed. When it came to fighting the enemies of God, the Camerlengo was the one man who would stand up and play hardball. The Swiss guards had seen a lot of the Camerlengo this week in preparation for conclave, and everyone had commented that the man seemed a bit rough around the edges, his verdant eyes a bit more intense than usual. Not surprisingly, they all commented, not only was the Camerlengo responsible for planning the sacred conclave, but he had to do it immediately on the heels of the loss of his mentor, the Pope. Chartrand had only been at the Vatican a few months when he heard the story of the bomb that blew up the Camerlengo's mother before the kid's very eyes. A bomb in church, and now it's happening all over again. Sadly, the authorities never caught the bastards who planted the bomb. Probably some anti-Christian hate group, they said, and the case faded away. No wonder the Camerlengo despised apathy. A couple months back, on a peaceful afternoon inside Vatican City, Chartrand had bumped into the Camerlengo coming across the grounds. The Camerlengo had apparently recognized Chartrand as a new guard and invited him to accompany him on a stroll. They had talked about nothing in particular, and the Camerlengo made Chartrand feel immediately at home. "Father," Chartrand said, "may I ask you a strange question?" The Camerlengo smiled. "Only if I may give you a strange answer." Chartrand laughed. "I have asked every priest I know, and I still don't understand." "What troubles you?" The Camerlengo led the way in short, quick strides, his frock kicking out in front of him as he walked. His black crepe-sole shoes seemed befitting, Chartrand thought, like reflections of the man's essence, modern but humble, and showing signs of wear. Chartrand took a deep breath. "I don't understand this omnipotent, benevolent thing." The Camerlengo smiled. "You've been reading scripture?"
"I try."
"You are confused because the Bible describes God as an omnipotent and benevolent deity."
"Exactly."
"Omnipotent benevolent simply means that God is all-powerful and well-meaning."
"I understand the concept, it's just... there seems to be a contradiction."
"Yes. The contradiction is pain. Man's starvation. War. Sickness."
"Exactly."
Chartrand knew the Camerlengo would understand.
"Terrible things happen in this world. Human tragedy seems like proof that God could not possibly be both all-powerful and well-meaning. If he loves us and has the power to change our situation, he would prevent our pain, wouldn't he?"
The Camerlengo frowned.
"Would he?"
Chartrand felt uneasy. Had he overstepped his bounds? Was this one of those religious questions you just didn't ask?
"Well, if God loves us, and he can protect us, he would have to. It seems he is either omnipotent and uncaring, or benevolent and powerless to help.
Do you have children, Lieutenant?
Chartrand flushed.
No, Signore.
Imagine you had an 8-year-old son. Would you love him?
Of course.
Would you do everything in your power to prevent pain in his life?
Of course.
Would you let him skateboard? Chartrand did a double take. The Camerlengo always seemed oddly in touch for a clergyman.
Yeah, I guess, Chartrand said.
Sure, I'd let him skateboard, but I'd tell him to be careful. So, as this child's father, you would give him some basic, good advice, and then let him go off and make his own mistakes. I wouldn't run behind him and mollycoddle him, if that's what you mean.
But what if he fell and skinned his knee?
He would learn to be more careful. The Camerlengo smiled. So, although you have the power to interfere and prevent your child's pain, you would choose to show your love by letting him learn his own lessons?
Of course. Pain is part of growing up. That's how we learn.
The Camerlengo nodded.
Exactly.
Chapter 90. Langdon and Vittoria observed Piazza Barberini from the shadows of a small alleyway on the western corner. The church was opposite them, a hazy cupola emerging from a faint cluster of buildings across the square. The night had brought with it a welcome cool, and Langdon was surprised to find the square deserted. Above them, through open windows, blaring televisions reminded Langdon where everyone had disappeared to. No comment yet from the Vatican. Illuminati murders of 2 cardinals. Satanic presence in Rome. Speculation about further infiltration. The news had spread like Nero's fire. Rome sat riveted, as did the rest of the world. Langdon wondered if they would really be able to stop this runaway train. As he scanned the piazza and waited, Langdon realized that despite the encroachment of modern buildings, the piazza still looked remarkably elliptical. High above, like some sort of modern shrine to a bygone hero, an enormous neon sign blinked on the roof of a luxurious hotel. Vittoria had already pointed it out to Langdon. The sign seemed eerily befitting. Hotel Bernini.
5 of 10, Vittoria said, cat eyes darting around the square.
No sooner had she spoken the words than she grabbed Langdon's arm and pulled him back into the shadows. She motioned into the center of the square. Langdon followed her gaze. When he saw it, he stiffened. Crossing in front of them, beneath a street lamp, 2 dark figures appeared. Both were cloaked, their heads covered with dark mantles, the traditional black covering of Catholic widows. Langdon would have guessed they were women, but he couldn't be sure in the dark. One looked elderly and moved as if in pain, hunched over. The other, larger and stronger, was helping.
"Give me the gun," Vittoria said.
"You can't just..." Fluid as a cat, Vittoria was in and out of his pocket once again. The gun glinted in her hand. Then, in absolute silence, as if her feet never touched the cobblestone, she was circling left in the shadows, arcing across the square to approach the couple from the rear. Langdon stood transfixed as Vittoria disappeared. Then, swearing to himself, he hurried after her. The couple was moving slowly, and it was only a matter of 30 seconds before Langdon and Vittoria were positioned behind them, closing in from the rear. Vittoria concealed the gun beneath casually crossed arms in front of her, out of sight but accessible in a flash. She seemed to float faster and faster as the gap lessened, and Langdon battled to keep up. When his shoes scuffed a stone and sent it skittering, Vittoria shot him a sideways glare. But the couple didn't seem to hear. They were talking. At 30 feet, Langdon could start to hear voices. No words, just faint murmurings. Beside him, Vittoria moved faster with every step. Her arms loosened before her. The gun started to peek out. 20 feet. The voices were clearer, one much louder than the other. Angry, ranting. Langdon sensed it was the voice of an old woman. Gruff, androgynous,
He strained to hear what she was saying, but another voice cut the night. Mi scusi.
Vittoria's friendly tone lit the square like a torch. Langdon tensed as the cloaked couple stopped short and began to turn. Vittoria kept striding toward them, even faster now, on a collision course. They would have no time to react. Langdon realized his own feet had stopped moving. From behind, he saw Vittoria's arms loosening, her hand coming free, the gun swinging forward. Then, over her shoulder, he saw a face, lit now in the street lamp. The panic surged to his legs, and he lunged forward. Vittoria, no! Vittoria, however, seemed to exist a split second ahead of him. In a motion as swift as it was casual, Vittoria's arms were raised again, the gun disappearing as she clutched herself like a woman on a chilly night. Langdon stumbled to her side, almost colliding with the cloaked couple before them.
Buonasera, Vittoria blurted, her voice startled with retreat.
Langdon exhaled in relief. The two elderly women stood before them, scowling out from beneath their mantles. One was so old she could barely stand. The other was helping her. Both clutched rosaries. They seemed confused by the sudden interruption. Vittoria smiled, although she looked shaken.
Dove la chiesa Santa Maria della Vittoria?
Where is the church of... The two women motioned in unison to a bulky silhouette of a building on an inclined street from the direction they had come.
E là!
Grazie, Langdon said, putting his hands on Vittoria's shoulders and gently pulling her back. He couldn't believe they'd almost attacked a pair of old ladies.
Non si può entrare,
one woman warned.
I chiesa temprano.
Closed early? Vittoria looked surprised.
Perché?
Both women explained at once. They sounded irate. Langdon understood only parts of the grumbling Italian. Apparently the women had been inside the church 15 minutes ago praying for the Vatican in its time of need, when some man had appeared and told them the church was closing early.
Hanno conosciuto l'uomo?
Vittoria demanded, sounding tense. Did you know the man? The women shook their heads. The man was a straniero crudo, they explained, and he had forcibly made everyone inside leave, even the young priest and janitor, who said they were calling the police. But the intruder had only laughed, telling them to be sure the police brought cameras.
Cameras?
Langdon wondered. The women clucked angrily and called the man a bararabo. Then, grumbling, they continued on their way.
Bararabo?
Langdon asked Vittoria.
A barbarian?
Vittoria looked suddenly taut.
Not quite. Bararabo is derogatory wordplay. It means Arabo, Arab.
Langdon felt a shiver and turned toward the outline of the church. As he did, his eyes glimpsed something in the church's stained glass windows. The image shot dread through his body. Unaware, Vittoria removed her cell phone and pressed the auto dial.
I'm warning Olivetti.
Speechless, Langdon reached out and touched her arm. With a tremulous hand, he pointed to the church. Vittoria let out a gasp. Inside the building, glowing like evil eyes through the stained glass windows, shone the growing flash of flames. Chapter 91. Langdon and Vittoria dashed to the main entrance of the Church of Santa Maria della Vittoria and found the wooden door locked. Vittoria fired 3 shots from Olivetti's semi-automatic into the ancient bolt, and it shattered. The church had no anteroom, so the entirety of the sanctuary spread out in one gasping sweep as Langdon and Vittoria threw open the main door. The scene before them was so unexpected, so bizarre, that Langdon had to close his eyes and reopen them before his mind could take it all in. The church was lavish, baroque, gilded walls and altars. Dead center of the sanctuary, beneath the main cupola, wooden pews had been stacked high and were now ablaze in some sort of epic funeral pyre. A bonfire shooting high into the dome. As Langdon's eyes followed the inferno upward, the true horror of the scene descended like a bird of prey.
High overhead, from the left and right sides of the ceiling, hung two incensor cables, lines used for swinging frankincense vessels above the congregation. These lines, however, carried no incensers now, nor were they swinging. They had been used for something else. Suspended from the cables was a human being. A naked man. Each wrist had been connected to an opposing cable, and he had been hoisted almost to the point of being torn apart. His arms were outstretched in a spread eagle, as if he were nailed to some sort of invisible crucifix hovering within the house of God. Langdon felt paralyzed as he stared upward. A moment later, he witnessed the final abomination. The old man was alive, and he raised his head. A pair of terrified eyes gazed down in a silent plea for help. On the man's chest was a scorched emblem. He had been branded. Langdon couldn't see it clearly, but he had little doubt what the marking said. As the flames climbed higher, lapping at the man's feet, the victim let out a cry of pain, his body trembling. As if ignited by some unseen force, Langdon felt his body suddenly in motion, dashing down the main aisle toward the conflagration. His lungs filled with smoke as he closed in. 10 feet from the inferno, at a full sprint, Langdon hit a wall of heat. The skin on his face singed, and he fell back, shielding his eyes and landing hard on the marble floor. Staggering upright, he pressed forward again, hands raised in protection. Instantly he knew the fire was too hot. Moving back again, he scanned the chapel walls. A heavy tapestry, he thought. If I can somehow smother the... But he knew a tapestry was not to be found. This is a Baroque chapel, Robert, not some damn German castle. Think! He forced his eyes back to the suspended man. High above, smoke and flames swirled in the cupola. The incensor cable stretched outward from the man's wrists, rising to the ceiling where they passed through pulleys and descended again to metal cleats on either side of the church. Langdon looked over at one of the cleats. It was high on the wall, but he knew if he could get to it and loosen one of the lines, the tension would slacken and the man would swing wide of the fire. A sudden surge of flames crackled higher, and Langdon heard a piercing scream from above. The skin on the man's feet was starting to blister. The cardinal was being roasted alive. Langdon fixed his sights on the cleat and ran for it. In the rear of the church, Vittoria clutched the back of a pew, trying to gather her senses. The image overhead was horrid. She forced her eyes away. "Do something!" She wondered where Olivetti was. Had he seen the Hashashin? Had he caught him? Where were they now? Vittoria moved forward to help Langdon, but as she did, a sound stopped her. The crackling of the flames was getting louder by the instant, but a second sound also cut the air, a metallic vibration, nearby. The repetitive pulse seemed to emanate from the end of the pews to her left. It was a stark rattle, like the ringing of a phone, but stony and hard. She clutched the gun firmly and moved down the row of pews. The sound grew louder. On, off, a recurrent vibration. As she approached the end of the aisle, she sensed the sound was coming from the floor just around the corner at the end of the pews. As she moved forward, gun outstretched in her right hand, she realized she was also holding something in her left hand. Her cell phone. In her panic, she had forgotten that outside she had used it to dial the commander, setting off his phone's silent vibration feature as a warning. Vittoria raised her phone to her ear. It was still ringing. The commander had never answered. Suddenly, with rising fear, Vittoria sensed she knew what was making the sound. She stepped forward, trembling. The entire church seemed to sink beneath her feet as her eyes met the lifeless form on the floor. No stream of liquid flowed from the body. No signs of violence tattooed the flesh. There was only the fearful geometry of the commander's head, torqued backward, twisted 180 degrees in the wrong direction. Vittoria fought the images of her own father's mangled body. The phone on the commander's belt lay against the floor, vibrating over and over against the cold marble. Vittoria hung up her own phone, and the ringing stopped. In the silence, Vittoria heard a new sound,
a breathing in the dark directly behind her. She started to spin, gun raised, but she knew she was too late. A laser beam of heat screamed from the top of her skull to the soles of her feet as the killer's elbow crashed down on the back of her neck.
"Now you are mine," a voice said.
Then everything went black. Across the sanctuary, on the left lateral wall, Langdon balanced atop a pew and scraped upward on the wall, trying to reach the cleat. The cable was still 6 feet above his head. Cleats like these were common in churches and were placed high to prevent tampering. Langdon knew priests used wooden ladders called puali to access the cleats. The killer had obviously used the church's ladder to hoist his victim, so where the hell is the ladder now? Langdon looked down, searching the floor around him. He had a faint recollection of seeing a ladder in here somewhere, but where? A moment later, his heart sank. He realized where he had seen it. He turned toward the raging fire. Sure enough, the ladder was high atop the blaze, engulfed in flames. Filled now with desperation, Langdon scanned the entire church from his raised platform, looking for anything at all that could help him reach the cleat. As his eyes probed the church, he had a sudden realization. Where the hell is Victoria? She had disappeared. Did she go for help? Langdon screamed out her name, but there was no response. And where is Olivetti? There was a howl of pain from above, and Langdon sensed he was already too late. As his eyes went skyward again and saw the slowly roasting victim, Langdon had thoughts for only one thing. Water. Lots of it. Put out the fire. At least lower the flames. I need water, damn it, he yelled out loud.
That's next, a voice growled from the back of the church.
Langdon wheeled, almost falling off the pews. Striding up the side aisle directly toward him came a dark monster of a man. Even in the glow of the fire, his eyes burned black. Langdon recognized the gun in his hand as the one from his own jacket pocket, the one Victoria had been carrying when they came in. The sudden wave of panic that rose in Langdon was a frenzy of disjunct fears. His initial instinct was for Victoria. What had this animal done to her? Was she hurt? Or worse? In the same instant, Langdon realized the man overhead was screaming louder. The cardinal would die. Helping him now was impossible. Then, as the Hashashin leveled the gun at Langdon's chest, Langdon's panic turned inward, his senses on overload. He reacted on instinct as the shot went off. Launching off the bench, Langdon sailed arms first over the sea of church pews. When he hit the pews, he hit harder than he had imagined, immediately rolling to the floor. The marble cushioned his fall with all the grace of cold steel. Footsteps closed to his right. Langdon turned his body toward the front of the church and began scrambling for his life beneath the pews. High above the chapel floor, Cardinal Guidera endured his last torturous moments of consciousness. As he looked down the length of his naked body, he saw the skin on his legs begin to blister and peel away.
"I am in hell," he decided. "God, why hast thou forsaken me?"
He knew this must be hell, because he was looking at the brand on his chest upside down. And yet, as if by the devil's magic, the word made perfect sense. Fire. Chapter 92. Three Ballarings. No Pope. Inside the Sistine Chapel, Cardinal Mortatti had begun praying for a miracle. Send us the candidates. The delay had gone long enough. A single missing candidate, Mortatti could understand, but all four? It left no options. Under these conditions, achieving a two-thirds majority would take an act of God himself. When the bolts on the outer door began to grind open, Mortatti and the entire College of Cardinals wheeled in unison toward the entrance. Mortatti knew this unsealing could mean only one thing. By law, the chapel door could only be unsealed for two reasons— to remove the very ill
or to admit late cardinals. The Preferiti are coming.
Mortati's heart soared. Conclave had been saved. But when the door opened, the gasp that echoed through the chapel was not one.